Welcome to the 34th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. Joining tonight's show, we have Layla, Fridge Gargoyle Miranova.
Hey guys!
Special guest from the Land Down Under and co-creator of the Old World League, Daniel Fenderstadt Wise.
Hello!
And I am Jesse Gitzman Burke. How's everybody doing tonight?
I'm very good.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on the show, Daniel.
Yes, good to be here. Good to be here.
Did Lester make it?
Lester is always here in spirit.
You know, I thought about getting just audio clippings of him and putting him in the show, kind of like you'd have like a teddy bear talking in the corner.
A soundboard.
Yes.
You can have something witty which he'd say. And
I think if we... motivation and time permitting, that might happen for next episode.
Seriously, Lester, but where are you? Shoot an email over or something. Don't you have a smartphone? Do they have those in Canada?
I think they do.
What, I mean, like, they're 2 seconds. I'm still alive, period. See you guys later.
Last email I got from him was a couple weeks ago. He said he was doing well, but I know he'll come back soon. It's just, I think it's hard to get a... I think you have to run a cable to each house in Canada. To get the internet. They have to run a series of tubes out to the house.
That sounds about right.
So news for this week, not a lot from the Fantasy Flight perspective, but there have been some fun kind of more Warhammer general stuff that I'd really like to talk to you guys about. There's not really any order to this, but the one thing that was really neat that I was able to get my hands on within the last couple weeks was a book called Tamarcon. And that is a book put out by Forge World, who is the sister company to Games Workshop. And this book is it's probably about a 150, 200 page book, very large, almost like a coffee table book. And it is meant to supplement the Warhammer Fantasy Battles tabletop game. But like every Warhammer book that comes out, they are littered with a heavy amount of fluff information about the Warhammer world in general. And this one in particular has a very heavy focus on Nurgle, specifically a Chaos Warlord who ascends to power, amasses a gigantic army, and the Chaos Warlord's name is Tamarcon, and he amasses this army and descends from the north to attack the Empire. But unlike the typical incursions from the north where they'd go through Kislev and then push down on the north of the Empire, Tamarcon decides to work his way down the mountains of Morn through the Ogre Kingdoms, across the Dark Lands, through Chaos Dwarf territory, through the Border Princes, and attack the Empire from the south. And the really neat thing about this book, outside of its amazing presentation, graphics, and all this kind of stuff, is it includes full army lists for these areas that he travels through, most notably a full complement of a Chaos Dwarf army.
That's cool.
I'm hearing the audible gasp from other people around the world as they hear that, because that's something that Games Workshop has more or less written out of existence for quite a long time. Last time I remember them being in the game was in 5th edition of Warhammer, which would have been something close to maybe 10 to 15 years ago.
It's a neat book, yeah. I mean, it's very well crafted. But can I just say this, and I mean this with a lot of respect, because it's a beautiful book, but seriously, could they just have somebody edit it, please? Because there's just so many grammar issues, and I mean, for a book that beautiful...
I mean, it is a beautiful book.
It is beautiful.
It's stunning to hold and touch and look at.
But not to read.
No. I mean, but it's... I think its vocabulary is amazing.
Yes.
The sentences are amazing, except they just need to work with their commas. And it seems typical of the way most of these books are written, though.
The grammar is just awful, and the sentences are so long that you lose track of what you're even reading.
But there are being a Nurgle book, it has so many different ways of saying corruption,
mm-hmm.
or feculent, or bubos, and
yeah.
corpulent.
I mean, whacked out the synonyms there on
oh,
Microsoft
man.
Word.
It's fantastic. There's so many ways to say diseased and disgusting. That's amazing. And Nurgle being my favorite, I had a lot of fun reading it. I'm not very far into it yet, but I'm really enjoying it. And if you like Warhammer and really like fluff books that are just a neat one to have on your shelf, this is definitely one. It's a little pricey. I think it ended up being about $75 or $80.
Oh, okay. I thought it was about $70.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a... and from what I understand, if I'm reading into this correctly, this is the first of four books. So I think we're going to see three more of these focusing on different... the other three Chaos Gods. And... I believe they're kind of presenting it in a way of almost maybe an alternate history of what could have happened, or I don't think these are actually things that are being written into the history. I read that somewhere, so I don't know if that's correct or not. Daniel, have you ever gotten into any of the kind of supplemental lore books of the game?
No, not really, actually. The only thing which would come close to that is, you know, the various second edition stuff, but only for the role playing, not for Warhammer in general.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have read the Witch Hunter's Handbook.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
That's a pretty neat one, I thought.
Yeah, I those little handbooks were great. The first one of those I encountered was the Imperial Guard's Uplifting Primer, which was a Warhammer 40,000 version, and it's like the little handbook you'd be given as a guardsman as you joined the army, and it's just full of unrealistic propaganda about how amazing your life is going to be as a soldier in the army. So from what I'm gathering then from your comment, it sounds like you began this game through the role-playing game?
That's right. Although when I was young, I experimented with Warhammer, and then was quickly scared off it by the price.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really return to it until 2 years ago when I picked up Warhammer 3rd. I always had a problem justifying Warhammer the more I got into it, Warhammer Fantasy Battles, because I'm like, you know, like, let's say Lizardmen versus Kislev or whatever, Lizardmen versus Bretonnia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, why would the Lizardmen sail all the way over there? You know, why would the Dark Elves, you know, risk a giant force attacking XYZ, you know, when they're limited in number and they should be concentrating on, you know, sporadic colonies which they could win? So I was too nerdy for Warhammer.
So you were really into the kind of the why aspects and how the different cultures you were having trouble taking it just as the game itself.
I was having trouble taking it as a game, and I have a problem with balance, if you know what I mean. Like,
uh-huh.
So the concept that armies must be balanced, if you know what I mean. If I was a Dark Elf, right, you know, I wouldn't look for gigantic Empire armies to fight, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, for sure.
I would pick. So I was too nerdy for Warhammer, even back then. And luckily I found Warhammer Roleplay.
Which lets us nerd out just the right amount.
Which lets us nerd out just the right amount, and it's not worried too much about balance.
Oh, great. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about the Tamarkan book, and maybe this kind of feeds nicely into our second news item, which is the Monstrous Arcanum, which is a book that was released just before Tamarkan, with a very similar goal to supplement the tabletop game. It provides both these books provide a very large bestiary of additional creatures that you can add into your games, along with some history and placement on, you know, where they'd come into play. Of course, the stat blocks are for the tabletop game, but that's not very difficult to, to translate into like a third edition stat line. But there's some really, really neat Nurgle things in particular, some new dragon types, a lot of new beasts. I've ordered the Monstrous Arcanum so I can give you guys a little bit of a preview of that, hopefully in our next episode. I ordered it from England, so I'm thinking it might still take a week or two to get here. Let's see. We went on a trip and we listened mm-hmm. to the first audio drama of one of the Warhammer books.
Anirion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was written by Gav Thorpe, who's I believe he's one of the original writers and creators of Warhammer Fantasy. Is that correct?
Isn't Anir in the isn't he high elf?
He is.
I've heard of the name. Isn't he like the?
He's like an elf lord or something.
Isn't he the king?
I think he was the first Phoenix king.
Phoenix king. Yeah. It's all coming back to me.
There you go. This book was an audiobook, a single CD audiobook. So the whole thing probably lasted roughly an hour. And it's done with a full, you know, backup sound effects and music, and every character is voice acted by somebody different. The production value was pretty high. The quality level was, I'd say, somewhere middle of the road. It had its ups and downs. But it was the story of of Anirian, basically how he came to power, and ultimately it's the story of the legend of where he took the Sword of Cain in order to attempt to destroy the powers of chaos and end the demon incursions forever. But ultimately that act results in the Sundering, which is a very traumatic event for the High Elves, which is exactly where the book ends. He pulls the sword out, and then it'll be followed up by a couple more audiobooks in the future. But just so you know, some Warhammer fantasy audiobooks are finally starting to hit the shelves. They have about 10 or 20 40K ones available, but if you're really dying for some audiobooks, they're starting slowly. What'd you think from a honest perspective of what you thought about it?
I mean, I'll be honest, I lost interest fairly quickly, but I don't know that has much to do with... Partially, it probably does. I thought there was a lot of battle description at the very beginning, and I kind of lost track of what was going on, but also I'm not a very auditory-driven person. Like, you give me stuff to listen to, I'll start to zone out after a while. So I, you know, could be the book, could be me, could be both.
I was ready for it to end when it did. I didn't think it was terribly good. I love Gav Thorpe and some of the stuff he's done, but I thought this was weak, but fun to see them starting it. I'm hoping they'll do some better stuff in the future.
The woman who does the voice, I thought, was great.
She did do good.
Yeah.
So jumping into some more specific fantasy role-playing news, we haven't seen a print-on-demand supplement for a while. The last thing we saw was the cards for the Shalion Priests. I think we're still a little ways off from seeing the new Enemy Within campaign, so we might be high time for some new print-on-demand supplements coming sometime in the future if we're going to kind of dig back to the way what they have released and the gaps in between release schedules. Daniel, what do you think? Do you think a print-on-demand supplement could be soon? Do you think we're going to see one before Enemy Within?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I would like to see another one, especially Moore. I think he needs to get a bit more actions in his repertoire. But to be honest, I'm not entirely sure.
Do you think if we were to see one come out before Enemy Within, realistically, what do you think the next one could be?
I think it would. I think it'd be somehow tied into the Enemy Within.
Really?
Somehow.
I hadn't considered that. What could we? Let's take that for a second. And so if we're gonna make a print-on-demand supplement that's going to tie into a campaign they're about to release, what kind of stuff could you include in that?
Well, let's say if one of the key NPCs was like a mega powerful top gold wizard or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you would get the print-on-demand could expand him, that type of thing, if you know what I mean. Making mm-hmm. NPCs more, you know, you'll probably have to use this guy in a fight. Maybe it's a bad guy. I would like to see something which makes the two products complement each other.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
That's the type.
Do you think at all that kind of tactic for making a print on demand would that still be a viable product if somebody did not purchase Enemy Within?
Yes, I think it would be, and they would need to design it both ways.
Yeah, I mean, you could do like a here's a single cool arc nemesis, and here's his associated action cards and items that he might have. I mean, that'd be kind of cool. You could make background stories for him.
And maybe, you could target market it to GMs as a joke, you know, the GM grief pack.
Well, actually, that ties in a little bit to our main topic, which is coming up in a little bit. We're going to be talking about why did GMs relish killing PCs, but we'll get into that shortly. So, Daniel, tell us a little bit more about the Old World League. We had Philip come on one of our previous episodes and promote it briefly. You guys seem to have made quite a bit of headway in getting that off the ground and having regular games going. You know, tell us a little bit more about it and how it's going.
All right, so it's going good. Basically, what Monsieur Boujon said last time is still applicable. It's still a online map tools, all fantasy ground, persistent character, multiple GM campaign.
So the multiple GM, what does that mean?
So what the Old World League is designed to do is designed to have a persistent character base, which GMs could run a session from, and players could play with their characters in that session. The reason why I originally pitched it to Philippe as a one-shot campaign, because I personally enjoy playing one-shots, and I enjoy running one-shots very much. But the thing I dislike about one-shots is the fact your character disappears forever afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
If you would have a place where you could store your characters, and if a GM has a time, he can come in, he can run a one-shot, a player gets to use character one, another GM, if he has time, he could run another one-shot, and then that same player can use that same character and still feel like he's progressing rather than continuously losing characters to the void.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have several characters who have been lost to the void in a couple of our one-shots. I should, maybe I could resurrect them in our,
Resurrect them as League mercenaries.
There you go. So wait, Snorri Gundriksen, I think, was my dwarf's name, and then Lester had Mario somebody or other.
Now, why do the characters have to be limited to this one shot?
All right, so the characters don't have to be limited to one shot. There are many different games going on in the league at the moment. I run one shots because I don't have time to commit to a full campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, we've got four GMs, myself included. I run one-shots. A bloke called Cutlass runs a persistent campaign through it, storing his characters on there. We have another bloke who I can't pronounce his name. It's like Serbak or something like that. He's running like a hybrid campaign. Philippe runs one to two sessioners. You can really turn up and do what you want as a GM or as a player. But the reason why I personally wanted to create it is so I could run one shots in addition to the two campaigns that I currently run.
And you'd mentioned a couple times during your description there that they're stored somewhere. Is that through the Obsidian portal?
That is through the Obsidian portal.
Now,
so,
for those not familiar with what Obsidian portal is, can you give us a description of what you guys use it for?
It's like a campaign blog, and it's got a couple of tools for creating and storing characters and writing up posts. We should post a link to it in the show notes.
Sure, absolutely.
And how we do it is we create the players create a character, and then they load up all their stats via a template which Philippe made. And that displays all the stats for all the GMs to look at and all the players to advance from there. So a GM could say, I want to run a game this date. And then the players will say, all right, I want to play with my character, Sullivan. So the GM would have a look at, would go to Obsidian Portal, click on Sullivan. We'll find out Sullivan has played in 3 adventures, has 3 experience, and the GM knows exactly what Sullivan has bought advance-wise. So these characters are legal, and they're transferable to each GM.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And
the reason why it's presented as an old world league, as an adventurer's guild, is because this gives the GM excuse to have any group of players anywhere in the world of Warhammer at any time. And the excuse is they're league mercenaries and they've been deployed here. So that gets over the character meeting each other, etc., etc.
And you can just kind of hop into some cool adventure anywhere. That was the most appealing part to me, because some part of me, I think I mentioned this a few episodes ago, I've always wanted to do an adventure in Lustria, kind of like, the conquistadors going to the New World and, you know, going for gold and discovering that the whole place is inhabited by dinosaurs. I just think that would be wildly exciting.
Yeah, well, the adventure I'm currently running on, it's just a bit of spoilers for the people playing in it, but it'll be revealed really early, is this one's a 2-sessioner. In the first session, they were attacked by Dark Elves on a ship. The ship got blew up, and now they're washed up on Albion, which is mm-hmm. a place I've always wanted to visit, so to speak, as a GM. And so now this gives me an excuse, because the problem with campaign play is I have 2 campaigns at the moment, but my stories and my characters are locked in specific areas. And I can't just pick them up and say, hey, you know, let's go to Naggaroth, if you know what I mean. I can't mm-hmm. do that.
But I mean, if you're within the old world of the Empire, that's not so difficult. But if you're going to take somebody across the world, yeah, that becomes a little more of an issue.
That's right. And with the League and say, hey, you got a commission from a noble. He said, go there and I want you to steal XYZ plot device from XYZ bad guy.
Sounds good. Well, you guys have invited anybody from the Reckless Dice crew to participate in one of your games. I think we're aiming to do it a little bit later this month. Is that right?
That is correct.
So, Layla, you're participating, yeah?
I am.
And we talked about what kind of characters we might want to use. I think, what did you end up deciding on?
I think I will be making myself a little halfling character with some pretty big ambitions.
You're going to play a male halfling as well.
Right? I am. I mean, it just seemed natural. I didn't even think about the possibility of there being a female halfling. So I will be playing a boy halfling, yes. He will be a chef with aspirations to outcook basically every halfling that has come before him.
So he's decided to venture the known and unknown world in search of
he has left the moot. The moot.
Mm-hmm. The moot.
Yes, he's left the moot with a friend.
Yeah, Stone Paunch. This is the origin story of Stone Paunch. Who's my ogre that I've yet to play?
And so they're kind of traveling the world together, looking for tasty new meals.
And you cook for Stone Paunch. And then he keeps you alive.
Correct. Also, I'm able to I'm a good, what do you call it? Not an archer. Archer? An archer.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're an archer.
So I will be shooting bows from atop Stone Paunch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we have a nice little symbiotic relationship planned here.
Yeah.
I think it'll be both entertaining and put for some creative role playing as well.
Yeah.
I'm thinking Big Daddy Little Sister from Bioshock.
Yeah, you're right on the money. I don't know if you know what that is. I'll show you a picture later, but it is right on the money there.
Okay.
I think we accidentally made exactly that relationship.
Oh, okay. All right.
But Stone Paunch will be a fun one, I'm thinking, because he's an ogre, but I kind of want to not necessarily play him like a typical ogre. Somebody his character backstory has kind of evolved through the help of the community, which is why I'm having a little more fun with it. I originally wanted him maybe to be an investigator or somebody who he thinks he's more intellectual than he actually is, and really is just kind of a poor investigator, but thinks he's doing a great job all the time and is always kind of going down the wrong path because of whatever reason, whether he's led by his stomach or whatever, and the halfling will kind of actually provide the brains, though he thinks he's providing half the brains as well.
Right.
And to what degree we're able to play off each other with that, where I'm thinking I'm making decisions, but you're making them, or, you know, I think in my head it makes for some really good back and forth between the characters.
Yeah, I think at the very least it'll be nice and goofy.
You know what that sounds like? That sounds like Penny and Inspector Gadget. That type of relationship. Where Gadget's got no idea what's going on.
You know what?
And he's solving all the problems.
Where have you been? You have the perfect analogies for all of our crazy witty antics.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly it.
It's making me feel so unoriginal, though.
Is it really? I'm thinking like we've...
Because all these ideas have been done.
I think they're tried and true, is what I'm hearing.
Oh, okay.
Well, I stopped watching TV 10 years ago, so my my analogies will run out as soon as you try and something modern. So.
Are you saying our ideas are old as well?
Oh. Old ones are better ones.
Well, I think either way, we're pretty excited to play later this month, so we will keep you guys updated on how that's going. Other quick news, the Buried But Not Forgotten episodes are all live now. We have another set of episodes coming up also later this month. Really excited to see where that goes because we had some of the best role-playing we've done in our last few sessions, which are absolutely very memorable.
Yeah.
They're all live.
Yeah. We got out the very latest one,
yep,
where there's
mm-hmm.
all the... Oh, okay, good.
So I don't know if we want to talk about it a little bit or not, but for those... We'll save it maybe for next episode to kind of dissect it a bit, but some of the best inter-party conflict that I think I've ever seen in a role-playing game of any system so far. It was an absolute blast. A lot of good comments on the people who have listened to it. A lot of fun.
And what was most awesome about it is that it happened so naturally. It was not pre-planned at all.
I mean, how many dice did we roll?
And everybody just like naturally took this organic stand based on their characters and like where they were at the moment. It was I think that's what made it so interesting for me, at least.
Yeah, so episode 9 is what we're referring to. If you need the backstory for where that kind of how that all came about, episode 7 and 8 are the ones that build up to it. All three of those sessions were recorded at once, so they kind of split up into three nice little listenable chunks.
I've listened to that, actually. You guys are very lucky to have such a very good group of players and a good GM.
Yeah, Michael does a great job.
Who did you side with?
Who did I side with?
Mm-hmm.
I understood... I like Conrad's nobility, but when it comes down with it, I think Lars is correct.
Mm. I think Conrad
would have
liked
to have sided with us. But I don't want to spoil that. I'm split down the middle. I agree in principle with Conrad, but in reality, I agree with Lars.
Lars and Ella, did they or didn't they? In your opinion?
I'd like to think that they didn't and that they think they did.
I love that. That's excellent.
We'll probably have to roll with that one. You know, it's funny because Conrad probably realistically wants to side with Lars in his head, but he's got too many things up his sleeve to leave it at that. Yeah, he has higher aspirations than to let it go. He has a golden egg in his pocket right now, so... He's going to try and leverage that if he can.
Mm-hmm.
And the last bit, we're getting ready to record our last session of Harrow or Thanes, so I'm thinking maybe our next episode might even include another review session of one of the written adventures. So I know we got a lot of positive feedback when we did that with the Horror at Hugeldahl game, where we kind of dissected it with the GM afterwards. I'm looking forward to doing that again for Harrow or Thanes. So, should be fun. All right, with that, we'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll talk about why do GMs relish killing their PCs. So why do GMs relish killing PCs? Daniel, you've certainly GM'd your fair share of games. Do you like killing PCs?
Short answer, no. Long answer, yes.
I think you put it exactly like I was thinking. I mean, there's you don't like it, but there's still something in the back there that just makes you happy, or you enjoy doing it, or you almost strive to do it occasionally. And I kind of wanted to dissect why GMs maybe have that. And I think this would be a good setup because you and I have both GM'd several games. We've played in several games, and then we have Layla's perspective, where she is predominantly played in games.
Mm-hmm.
And she brought this up. She was fascinated. Like, why are you so excited to, like, maybe kill one of us tonight? And it...
Because there was glee.
There was a lot of glee.
There was glee in his voice when we were about to play and do the session that we just did. And tonight is the night I slay you all. But it wasn't just him, though, because Michael Wilson had a very similar... attitude towards trying to kill one of us off. So, and so did Chris Wagner for that one.
Every GM who's had especially during the climactic encounters.
Yeah.
There's a certain something that you're like, well, maybe I'll get to kill one of you guys tonight. Because I feel like we follow a set of rules as a GM. We don't necessarily target somebody to kill, but we certainly provide opportunities where we could slay somebody, and I find that very exciting. I mean, Daniel, have you ever encountered that? Or
have you ever killed one of your PCs?
Well, my home games are very different in the player death department. Now, I've only directly killed one PC in two years of Warhammer. Due to an encounter. I've almost lost PCs, but how I get player turnover is my players all kill each other.
What do you mean? We almost did it in Michael Wilson's game.
Well, I didn't want to kill anybody.
You shot an arrow at me.
You are still taking that personally.
And that's how it all starts.
Yeah, we do not know what our road trip home is going to look like still in that game. I'm sorry, Dane. I'm sorry to interrupt there. I was really interested in what you were saying. I just kind of got sidetracked by being flashbacked of having arrows shot at me.
It wasn't you personally.
I think it was.
Okay.
So what I enjoy more about, you know, potentially killing a PC is its drama and its suspense, you know. And when a player's on his last legs, everything's more tense. So the GM's more voted, yeah, I'm going to kill you, even though you may not really want to. Sometimes you are, yeah, I'm going to kill you, and the player's like, oh, no, don't kill me. You know, I gotta rise up against this overwhelming force. That's it. That's more what I enjoy about killing PCs. It's getting response from players.
There's a certain sense of danger that you instill in a game when you actively show the mortality of the characters, that at any given point, your character could be all gone.
That's right.
I think it's necessary. I mean, because if you didn't have that possibility, then you're not playing... You're not playing... for real, essentially, or genuinely.
Like, if you know that you're going to live through every encounter because I'm going to tweak it, I'm going to make the bad guy run at the last minute so you guys all live every time, that...
It takes the fun and the tension out of it, yeah.
It's crap, that's what it is.
I mean, do you recall, Helga felt that way for a long time because she had not...
been hurt
for several games in a row.
Yeah.
And she was feeling... pretty hot shit. And then all of a sudden one game, she got hit real hard a few times, and all of a sudden you all of a sudden played the character very differently from that point on, where your mortality all of a sudden set in.
That's true, yeah.
I mean, Dave has almost died, should have died.
Dave is on the brink of death pretty much every episode.
But, I mean, he's managed to survive. Chris's character in our last game...
spoiler.
Which has, that one has not gone live yet, but, but that'll probably be live by the time this goes up. Was very close to death in our finale of The Harrower of Thanes, which was a blast.
Mm-hmm.
We can discuss with him how that went when we do the recap.
And, you know, to be honest, that adventure was probably more entertaining because of the possibility of death, because... I mean, it gets pretty tense. It does towards the end. So
I mean, I didn't do anything different to design that adventure. I played it from the book, but I knew that you guys would be facing some of the biggest things you had faced yet, and the opportunity for somebody to die or be knocked out or something was probably the highest to date.
And it makes the characters act differently too, because now that I'm dissecting it, I mean, definitely Helga's actions were different because of the situation, so.
Daniel, you've killed one character before.
That's
Can you
right.
describe kind of what happened there?
It was just a straight out. Combat. While I have set up so players can kill many, many characters, my only direct kill was. Three players were fighting a wargor.
Mm-hmm. Which, for those of you who are following along, is the chieftain of a beastman tribe.
Big beastman, yeah. Not necessarily the biggest. He's not necessarily the smartest, but he smashes the most stuff.
He's the alpha male.
The alpha male. He knows what's going on. Smashing wise, and he was going to town on the players, and one player managed to put him down, but the wargor has this, it's like a last action kill,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like last breath or something like that, where he impales him, and the player managed to put him down, but yeah, that last action killed him in dramatic fashion,
excellent.
And then he got knocked out and then went over his critical ratio. And died in gory fashion. And that was good, because that was dramatic, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Well, I think once you guys have an opportunity to listen to the third episode of The Harrower of Thanes, I think you'll really enjoy the last encounter there, because that was probably one of the most dramatic battles we've had to date. And it really did illustrate, I think, how characters role-play best on the brink of death.
Mm-hmm.
Role-playing, storytelling, everything happened so much more organically because everybody felt in that moment so much stronger. I think we'll have some fun with that. I mean, I've only killed one PC before, and that was in a narrative setting where the player had crept to the into a cultist lair, and in doing so had... he was all by himself and woke up the cultist lair and ended up having to fight them one-on-one, and they put him down and ended up slitting his throat and bringing him off to be part of the sacrifice. So they knocked him out, and they didn't have time to deal with him, so they took him out. It was more of a, you know, sorry dude, that was a really horrible decision. I don't have anything else that these guys can do with you at the moment. The throat was slit.
But it made sense within the story, didn't it?
Absolutely. Oh, it did.
So you didn't, like, open the door, you die.
Right, exactly. No, he even in the time was saying, you know, God, this is really stupid of me, and yep, I fully expect to die right now. And it happened. And it was great, though, because what happened following that was the rest of the party realized this guy never came back, so went to investigate and stumbled across his slain corpse before encountering the cultists again. So, oh, that's what happened. Uh-oh. You know, one of the other things I find fun or intriguing is, do you feel, Daniel, that as a GM, do you feel there's a sense of payback? I don't mean that in a negative way, but almost in a fun way, where you get, you know, you sit there and have your creatures slain and your cool bad guys slain all day long, and the PCs get to run around with cool treasure and stuff. And is there a sense of you know, getting a little bit of payback in there if you get to knock the PCs around a little bit?
For me, not at all. as my objective is to make the PCs struggle hard and come out on top. I do not harbor any resentment. Maybe that's not the right word, but I don't definitely feel payback when I put down a PC, especially since I'm usually not the one who does it. The other players.
So I'm curious about this idea of how you've got your players to kill each other. Can you illustrate an example or two of that?
All right. Well, basically, this is what happens. All right. So our four guys create their characters. Right. One guy creates like a character who just wants to rape everyone. Let's be honest. That's their objective. That's his objective, is to assault female NPCs.
What's the career for that?
Thug, usually.
Disturbed?
The rapist?
Yes. So.
I mean, honestly, if I was playing with a character who was wanting to rape people, I'd be a little concerned.
So everyone's like, no, you can't do that. And then he'll do all types of types of nasty stuff, and then he'll conspire against us, and we'll conspire against him, and then he'll try and assassinate one of us, and then it actually works, if you know what I mean. Like, Warhammer is not the nicest game, and we usually never let him do it. In one occasion, though, we actually set up a scene where he got captured, and you know that scene in Pulp Fiction when the when they get captured by those two hillbillies and they're down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we set one of that thing up for him, and he was the bald dude. That was amusing. But it's character conflict. That's what it is.
Yeah, to that effect of character conflict, Troy Christman had commented a little while back that if one of the players in a group is a witch hunter, he should really be kind of a thorn in the party's side at times, and it should kind of create this party tension where the players are not only fighting each other half the time, but also fighting the world around them. And it sounds like you guys have pretty successfully done things like that.
Well, actually, in my online regular campaign, not the old World League, I have a zealot who is he represents everything Sigmar, if you know what I mean, and he's exactly that. He's a thorn in the side. He does what's right in terms of society. So, you know, there's a family whose mother worshipped chaos or whatever. The whole family goes down for conspiring with them, if you know. He's that type of guy, and it's I don't know whether it's me, but in my campaigns, the players are just always at each other. I don't know if it's because I subtly push buttons to make them hate each other, but...
Well, it sounds like your players already kind of like that idea and have discovered how much fun it can be to be conflicted with each other beyond the world. And I totally get that after having played our last few games, especially with Michael Wilson, where... It was so much fun to be competing or opposed to the other players and having this direct dialogue that was happening. It was some of the most fluid role-playing we'd done. And I could see that becoming, like, always wanting more of that, because that was really cool.
Player versus player, the stakes are higher. That's what it is. It's not you versus the NPC, who's going to let you... His objective is to... help you, if you know what I mean. But player versus player stakes are higher because it's you versus, you know, your ally, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a character with just as much rights as you.
What do you think about, when a player does die, that usually means somebody gets to make a new character. Maybe someone's bored with their character, wants to kill them off. Maybe they just die and have to write up a new character. It is kind of a fresh start and a opportunity to inject some new energy into a group when someone is killed.
That is true.
I mean, Helga was considering committing suicide at one point.
I mean...
She just needed to talk to someone.
She just needed a bear.
You really want the bear.
The bear has given her a new lease on life. The prospect of one.
The prospect of one.
Yeah.
Have you ever encountered, Daniel, a total party kill or a full wipe?
Whoa.
I have been a player and have been been totally wiped out as a player, but I've fortunately never done it as a GM.
And what are your thoughts on it? I mean, do you think it's something that should happen, should never happen, lets it happen organically?
I think it should happen if it makes sense in the story. That's what I think. I don't think it's a bad thing, but you know, if you're getting wiped out all the time, like every third, fourth session, that's the wrong way to do it. But if it's dramatically appropriate for you to go down, that's what happens.
You know, I did one of my favorite sessions I've run, which was going on about 2 years ago now. We had run a third edition version of the second edition Thousand Thrones campaign. We did the last segment of it, The Womb of the Black Witch, which is just effectively a dungeon romp. And we did it at a convention, so everybody made their characters. Anybody who died was dead and they were done. But it's a very brutal dungeon, but twisted with chaos in every way, shape, and form. But ultimately, we ended the adventure where everybody had, who was still alive, was mutated and horrible. Throughout this dungeon, they'd just become all sorts of corrupt. But they ultimately had to dispose of this, you know, arcane artifact to save the world. And they threw it through this portal into the realm of chaos, and they were so traumatized, and knowing they could never go back to the world again in the state that they were in with the mutations and these horrible things that had happened to them, that they all threw themselves into the portal and into the realm of chaos as well, effectively committing mass suicide after saving the world. And it was just such a tragic and beautiful ending to a cool, convention game.
True, and with also, you know, dramatically appropriate, but with, you know, total party knockouts, TPKs, where it's appropriate, you know, you don't always have to kill your characters, if you know what I mean. So if you're taking a bandit guy, taking on like a bandit group, and they knock you out, maybe they tie you up, steal your stuff, and maybe you're their prisoners, and you got to get about waiting for a chance to get out. Like, kill them where it's dramatically appropriate, but always, I think, where appropriate as well, keep them alive. If they're not mechanically dead, if they're not over their critical rating, if they're still alive mechanically, maybe it's better for the story that they survive.
I really want to talk about what happens to Chris's character right now in the finale of Harrow of Fane, so I'm going to hold on to it for one more episode because it's so perfectly appropriate to what you're talking about right now, but I don't want to spoil how that plays out, so I'm going to attempt to bite my tongue a little longer. So let's check in with the listeners. As always, you can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com, on Facebook under Reckless Dice, or hit us up on Twitter at Reckless Dice, like Treehorn, who emails...
Treehorn?
Treehorn. I know it's a third edition podcast, but I think it could be interesting to role play out one encounter with both third edition and second edition and compare the results afterwards. I mean, it's certainly not something we can do this very moment, but I think the concept of that's pretty interesting. I think a lot of times during our show, we've, especially in the earlier episodes, compared elements of second edition and how to kind of update it to use third edition rules mechanics. They are different, pretty substantially. I think there's a lot more dice rolling and mathematics going on in the dice rolls in second edition.
Hmm.
We should consider doing that. Daniel, what do you think the best way to do that would be to actually kind of what would be a good example of how to a nice like little segment that we could play out at some point and try that?
I reckon you should do a social one, So a haggling thing, or maybe you're going to try and convince someone. What was that? Daylight Chilling Short. You know that
the introductory adventure.
Merchant bloke.
Mm-hmm.
The one with no brains. He has a parcel, right? And you got to convince him to give it, and he doesn't want to give it over to you. So you could highlight the difference in the social mechanics. And you can also do a fight. I actually run a second edition campaign in addition to a third. So I am discovering the differences firsthand every week.
Yeah, I haven't played a second edition one for so long now that I'm not even sure I know the rules by heart anymore. Maybe we'll have to work with you, Daniel, and see if we can find a way to do this.
Oh, I'm terrible at second edition, to be honest. So there are far more experienced Warhammer players who could help you with that, as I started with third and degraded myself to second edition to give that a go.
All right, fair enough. Aaron Mokhtar posted on Facebook,
"Hola!
Hope y'all are having, having a great weekend."
Wait a minute, where is this guy from?
I think he moved to Texas.
To Texas.
Texas.
I mean, he moves all over. I think he was the Philippines.
Indonesia?
Indonesia. There you go. He's near my time zone.
And he says he hopes you're having a great weekend. He has some questions regarding standalone adventures that Fantasy Flight has produced. And I really, really liked these. His three questions that all kind of tie together, and I think they're great for discussion. As a new GM, should I jump straight into a standalone adventure or start with a random adventure or travel to get used to the system first? Daniel, do you want to take a crack at that one?
Already half answered these things, Zach. Can you come back to me? I'll find where I answered them on the Facebook page.
Sure. Yeah, actually, yeah, you're right. There was some discussion on the Facebook page, but I brought it on the podcast because I thought it would be some really good kind of broad discussion. My personal opinions on this are, I think the Daylight and a Shilling Short are a fantastic introductory adventure. I would not suggest trying to come up with some random encounter or mechanic because it'll feel a little disjointed. Give your players some context and incentive to make the game happen, and the dice rolls will make more sense, I think.
I would start small as a brand new GM. I mean, I tried to jump into an adventure and thought it would be fine, but it is pretty difficult.
As a GM, to
maneuver a whole set of players in a world that you're not completely familiar with quite yet. So
yeah, that was the Winds of Magic adventure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I pretty much said the same thing, except that I said, do whatever you want, mate. That's what you say in Australian, mate.
Is it? I've never heard that before.
What?
But I also said start with a day like Shilling Short.
I think that is good. I do not suggest starting with, I've forgotten its name now. The one from...
Song.
That's part of his next comment. The adventure that comes in the core book,
Eye
for an Eye, I think that's a wonderful adventure. I would highly suggest doing Daylight and a Shilling Short first because it's a bite-sized one. You can do it in one sitting, and you don't have to juggle a number of NPCs. And that tends to be the hardest thing for me, especially when you're beginning, just juggling way more characters than you're comfortable with. And Eye for an Eye has many NPCs. I think it's something like 17 or 18. Even though a lot of them you can kind of set aside and not touch if you need to, it's still quite a few to juggle.
Blackfire Pass is a better one for a new one to start as well. As there are a few NPCs in that, but they're not in the room at once. You don't need to juggle. So.
And that adventure is relatively linear, which is really, really nice when you're first starting out, where you do an encounter, and when you move on to the next encounter, the one before it never comes up again. And the ones ahead of it, you don't need to know about them until you get to them. Each location is very modular in that respect, so you can kind of take on as much as you're comfortable with without having to juggle too much.
Yeah, anything with particular timing elements that you have to get the timing right in order for the adventure to go off, I would not recommend that as a first-time GM.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going on in the Winds of Magic adventure.
There was. And even in the first one I did at the Pacificon, just mm-hmm. like kind of there was some timing in that too, and I ended up just ignoring all of it and improvising. So.
Yeah. Aaron's second question, is it better to use any standalone adventure I want for my group and just adjust the difficulty based on the PC rank, or do adventures specifically, or are adventures specifically made for a certain rank?
I think as a GM, you could probably adjust.
I'm a big fan of adjusting to, I think the story that's written is more important than the stat block that the enemies you're fighting are. If there's a story you're excited about, find a way to adjust it to fit your, you know, have one less bad guy or one more bad guy, or swap out the goblins for orcs, or swap out the orcs for trolls, or, you know, whatever you need to do to make it a little bit harder or easier. There's a lot of, every race in Warhammer from an enemy perspective has different tiers of difficulty within a family of creatures, so it's very easy to upscale or downscale encounters if it's necessary. Have you had experience doing that, Daniel?
I generally don't change difficulties because I find in 3rd edition, changing stats, the type of difficulty in the adventure is based on what you fight, not the number of.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a level 1 character fighting a troll, let's say take Witch's Song, right?
Yep.
You know how there's a bit with the troll. There can't really be anything other than a troll there.
Right.
If you know what I mean, at that particular adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And like the troll in, what was that thing, Gathering Storm? Like, there needs to be a troll there. I find the difficulty is easily changed on a base level, but what makes these 3rd edition adventures hard is the big bad, and sometimes you can't remove the big bad, but maybe you can find a way around it.
Yeah, there's certainly, you can adjust it through environmental factors, the addition of an NPC, you could make the big bad guy already slightly wounded. There are some things if you really need to tweak it, but this kind of feeds nicely into Aaron's last question, which is, his party is currently geographically located in the Cursed Marshes, which is up in the kind of northwest area of the Empire, and that happens to be where the Witch's Song adventure takes place. And he's wondering, you know, for his new group, is this an adventure that he could realistically run for those guys? What do you think about that? Because we ran that adventure. I know I have a few personal thoughts on it.
I think Witch's Song is too tough for new guys. It's possible to do it with new guys, but you'll be losing characters. As you know, you got the Chaosborn to worry about. You got a big, giant, unstoppable octopus who mainly needs to be killed by plot device. But what makes it difficult for a completely new player is that the severity of the situation, the severity of the witch hunter showing up, the relationship between the witch and chaos, and
let's not forget just the marsh itself.
Itself, like walking around in that marsh, I don't know if you've seen it later, but there's a table full of terrible things to do just walking through that marsh.
I was a huge proponent of not going into the marsh during that adventure.
A clever one.
And the dwarves said, sure, let's do it.
And the dwarves just keep on going.
No, I love those random encounter tables. I think every role-playing game should have them in an adventure somewhere because they're just so much fun usually. And that table for the marshes was excellent. It's not quite as good as the marsh table from the Thousand Thrones adventure near the early parts of that game. There's an amazing trek through the swamp there that just has a brilliant random generated table of horrible things to happen to you while you're in a marsh. But good fun either way. All right, our last question for tonight from Troy Chrisman. Troy asks, am I missing something? Where are the Skaven? Seems a full-on Skaven box sourcebook adventure should be on the horizon. Just doesn't seem 3rd edition has really fleshed them out yet, unless they are in an expansion I have yet to buy.
I don't have much thought on the Skaven.
We haven't done much with them yet in our games.
They're in the Edge of Night.
They are in the Edge of Night. I think that's really the only one, aside from they have a little trickle of content in Heroes Call. They have a fair amount of content in the Bestiary box set. But otherwise, Edge of Night is, I think, all we're really going to be seeing for the time being. That pretty fully flushed them out, actually. I think I disagree with Troy to some degree. I think the Skaven have just about all they need to play. I mean, if you think... that's assuming you have the majority of the content out there, but Edge of Night's the one you want if you need more Skaven stuff. We've got the Slaves, we've got the Gutter Runners, we've got the Storm Vermin, we've got the Clan Rats, we've got Rat Swarms, we've got the Poison Wind Globedeers, we've got the Grey Seer, we've got the Rat Ogre, we've got the special Rat Ogre Bone Ripper.
Are
we've
you
got
doing the this Abomination. Off the top of your head?
I am.
What the heck?
We've got the Abomination from the Heroes called the Pit Abomination. I think that covers almost the entire Skaven catalog of creatures with the exception of a few special ones like Jazael Teams or Warp Fire Throwers. So I don't think there's a whole lot left.
No, I would like to see them in an adventure in the future, but it's better than having them forced down the throat all the time, like in second edition. They were bloody everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I'm a fan of this game, and I think they're pretty good, but I'm glad to see them given someone else a go. Like someone like the Orcs. The Orcs never got a proper run.
I'm such a fan of the Greenskins, which is why I really enjoy doing the Harrow of Thanes adventure, because there's just loads of Greenskins in there.
And they're getting some good attention in 3rd edition.
It's about time. And they they're the whole focus of the Heroes Call adventure, which I'm thrilled to play at some point. Actually, to Aaron's earlier point, where we're kind of substituting content, I was thinking, because I've been really excited about this Tamarkan book that I got, I was thinking it'd be really fun to do an adventure, which is effectively the Heroes Call adventure, but substitute the Orcs for Tamarkan and his Chaos Horde. And you could just as easily run the exact same adventure. You just swap out one bad guy for another. And it wouldn't be too hard, I don't think. We'll see. Maybe in one of our future live play sessions, you guys won't see the Orcs. You'll see Tamarkan. All right. Well, I think that will wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Thank you, Layla. Thank you, Ghost of Lester.
Lester, come back.
Thank you, Daniel.
No worries.
Until next time, guys, thanks for listening.
I mean, when I think of Australia, I think of kangaroos. Do you see kangaroos on an everyday kind of basis?
They are way more common than you think.
They are more common than you think.
Are they like stray cows? Well, let me qualify that. Out here in California, we have like countryside, right, where cows just sort of roam. Happy California cows.
Are they wild or are they...
They're owned, but in a very large pasture that you couldn't even see the gates.
Yeah, so basically they're just like randomly all over the countryside in certain areas.
Well, we have that, but
that's kind of how we're picturing the kangaroo.
The kangaroo.
A kangaroo is a wild animal. Like they just go wherever they want.
Yeah.
They don't have pastures which they live in, and they.
Say you're out on a day trip one day through some random part of the countryside, are you going to stumble onto a kangaroo?
Depends. If you're out hiking, you probably will. Different areas, the more country you go, the more kangaroos you see. Do you hear stuff about Australia killing kangaroos all the time? And
yeah, there's a lot of poaching going on, yeah?
It's completely warranted. kangaroos are a pest. I go out and shoot. I used to go out and shoot kangaroos.
Really?
Yeah. They are everywhere. There's a state called ACT, Australian Capital Territory. The highest form of death, roadside accident, is kangaroo strikes.
That's like deer. Yeah. Okay. So there may be like deer.
And that's probably the same frequency then, because we have a lot of, like, when you go hiking here, you don't see anything, but you might see
deer. You might see a deer. Yeah.
That's right. Well, we have deer here, but of course they're not native, and they are hard to track and hard to hunt, but they're around.
So can you pet a kangaroo? Can you make friends with a kangaroo?
They're dangerous.
They are dangerous. You don't fuck around with kangaroo, that's for certain. They are not friendly. Most of the time they'll back off, but if they can't back off or you come against a male, he will kick the shit out of you. That's what they do. They get up in their tail and they boost. Mm-hmm.